Welcome to the Good Hard Story Podcast, where we believe that the good story and the hard story can be the exact same story. I'm Catherine Wolf, and I'm a stroke survivor, a speaker, an author, and co-founder of Hope Heals. Tune in here every week for conversations about wholeheartedly living in a good hard story. Join me in this joyful rebellion to the darkness where we discover the treasures hidden in our hurting. What a blessing to have Amy Julia Becker and Jay Wolf with me today on the Good Hard Story Podcast. Amy Julia, well, y'all can say hi so it doesn't seem like just me talking.
Hello, it's nice to be here with you too.
So I want to acknowledge that, Amy Julia, you are quite brilliant. You went to Princeton undergrad, got a MDiv at Princeton, and are just a crazy, super brilliant and very just wise woman. And you're like really, really, really my really smart friend. I feel so cool that I'm your friend because you're like one of those brilliant people. And
we all need one of those.
Yeah, we do. And I'm just in awe that you are such a champion of our little ministry. It's just such a gift to have you on our board, making just visionary-esque decisions left and right with us, and really crafting just our, not only our perspective on disability, which you do so beautifully, because you are a thought leader, culture maker in those realms, but also you're a brilliant author who's written 4 books, and I don't know, you're just an incredible human being, and to have you come alongside us is just a deep blessing, wouldn't you say, Jay?
It is. I can't add anything else to that intro. And I'm wondering what my intro is going to be. A little shorter, I think.
Jay Wolf okay. is my husband.
I concur with everything.
I'm just kidding.
No, yeah, I mean, Amy Julia has, you've helped us shape a lot of our thinking in some of these areas where our compassion has grown in 15 years and our longing for words around this lived theology that we have felt, you know, sort of in our bodies and in our broken hearts. And how does that then lead us out into the world and to look outside to others who are hurting in all these different arenas? I mean, your wisdom has just kind of has guided us in a lot of really nuanced and complex arenas. So thank you. And again, you're so humble too. And it's a conversation. So thanks for having more humble conversations about compassion and pain and how God meets us in all of those places.
Well, thank you both. I mean, I will say, I kind of feel like the Princeton part might be overrated just in the sense that
no.
There's so much. Well, I've always loved school and I really do love reading and thinking. And I'm so glad that I get to do that. I hope that I also, though, and this has happened so much more after graduation than it did, you know, in my early life, the chance of being able to actually, as you just said, Jay, like have conversations where, sure, maybe I can offer something, but I also am learning so much. And the learning comes not only from listening to equally brilliant people like the two of you, but yeah. also from living the lives that we live, right? And from knowing the people we know, many of whom don't have the same educations or the same backgrounds, many insights that come, in fact, in part because of not having those backgrounds. So I guess as much as I really want to use what I've been given in a way that doesn't like be dismissive, I don't want to be dismissive of it. I also want to have it in kept in its proper place because I've been given this thing and I want to use it well, but I also want to really acknowledge the fact that, you know, as you all know, in my case, here I am, this intellectual who went to Princeton and went to Princeton Seminary and have always loved books and readings. And I was given a child with an intellectual disability. And She has been intellectually a tremendous gift to me because of how much she's expanded, not just my heart, but actually the way I think about, like, my mindset on faith, my mindset on the world, my mindset on community, and certainly being able to walk alongside you all and the many people you've brought into the Hope Heals orbit for, you know, a couple of years now, only continues that really beautiful work of expanding the way I see and learn and grow in this world. So anyway, thank you for that introduction, but also, you know, don't believe all the press.
Well, first of all, I've never really connected that you're so intellectual and your daughter has an intellectual disability. I've sort of gauged it. I mean, I don't know. That's very powerful, Amy Julia, actually. I guess for some reason it makes me teary because I know Penny and Penny is brilliant. So it must be a mother with such incredible deep intellect that is reaching into those places. And Penny is phenomenal. I kind of can't believe we get to know her and your family. And that was what I wanted to start by asking you about was, have you been to Hope Heals Camp 3 years or 2 years? It feels like since the beginning. It feels like 7 years.
Yeah, only 2 years, actually. Yeah, just
crazy.
The past 2 summers.
You're just such camp family. It's bizarre you've only been here that short of a time. So last summer, you taught the children's programming, and this summer, you're teaching volunteer programming. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes, last summer, I got to use the Jesus Storybook Bible and a verse from Romans 15 about hope and the way in which the Holy Spirit pours hope into our hearts so that it will overflow. And it was really moving for me.
Is it maybe Romans 15:13? Maybe we should share that one because somebody needs to hear that one today. I think it says, may the God of hope fill you with joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. When I had a separate brain aneurysm and was going to have voluntary aneurysm surgery, and I say voluntary like necessary voluntary surgery 5 years after my stroke, a sweet group of nearly 100 people from our church gathered between services the day before and got in a big circle and had our family, which was just Jay, James, and I at the time. John wasn't born yet. Actually, the removal of the aneurysm allowed me to get pregnant safely with John, but he wasn't in the picture yet. And as we stood in the middle of the circle, that group just prayed and prayed and anointed with oil. And one sweet friend just looked over at me and saw my face and just said, I cannot believe this is happening to you. And it was like so spiritual, so sacred, so healing to have a sweet Christian sister pouring it out to the Lord, but to say in the very same breath, I cannot believe this is happening to your life. Haven't you been through enough? I mean, my goodness. And it was life-changing for me. I felt so seen and known because she was with me and lifting up my eyes to the Lord. And yet she was with me in, I cannot believe this is your reality on earth. And I long to be that for other people, to hold that tension so well.
You reference that often, Catherine. I think that it's interesting of all the things said to you, encouraging and commiserating and all of that. I've heard you say that the most, that turn of phrase, which is interesting because that may not be the most
go-to
phrase somebody thinks to say to somebody to encourage them. But there is a certain sense of like, I don't need someone's certainty when I'm suffering.
Right.
I just need that sense of an I see you, I grieve with you. And I don't, like, none of us knows what this is going to look like. We ultimately are anchored to a bigger story that we're a part of. And yet there is sort of this sense of, you know, to be human is a lot. And to be in this world and showing up and trying to be faithful and trying to love well and still finding yourself at the mercy of a broken world and of suffering is just, it feels a lot of feels. There's a lot of layers of just grief to that. But to do it in community certainly is this incredible boost and a healing sort of next, a step forward towards healing.
I'm thinking back to actually before Penny was even born, a friend of mine died and who was a young kid, who got in a car accident. And I remember up until that point in my Christian life, I think I had understood or felt like I understood why things happened, even if they were bad, like there's something good came out of it, or, you know, I could tell a story that came to a conclusion that made sense to me.
Right.
And there was no way to make sense of an 18-year-old dying in a car crash. Like, I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And so it was the first time, there have been many since then, when I had to come to that point of either saying, I understand that I don't understand.
Right.
Or I got to walk away from my faith altogether. Like, I either have to move forward with a surrender to the mystery of God's goodness and love, even in the face of total tragedy, I have to say it can't be true and walk away. And it really was a wrestling match for me and has been since then. But I think, Catherine, those words somewhat stand in the midst of that space. And we are going to cry out to God on your behalf, and we are going to be 100% for you and trusting that goodness and love, even while we're at the same time saying, I don't understand. And I think it's really more like so often we run into within the church, people saying there's a reason, there's an answer. You know, if you just have enough faith, you'll get your tidy bow on the package thing. And outside of the church, you just run into the like, well, therefore, you know, there is no answer because we live in an absurd world. Right.
Yes.
And standing in that place in between, I think that's a scriptural and faithful place to be, but it's also a lot less neat and tidy.
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. And yes, so many times God uses that tension in my life, in all of our lives, is we don't have understanding and reasoning and all the words, but we're just going to say, like, I can't believe this. Doesn't mean I don't somehow trust God. It doesn't mean that I'm, you know, walking away or whatever. It just means this is shocking and horrible, and I'm so sorry. And there's space for that. Just the whole notion of a Christian response being a one of toxic positivity just makes me so, so angry, because I've just had too much experience through these years with our camp families in particular, who have had just bizarre, hurtful, scripture weaponized, just really cruel statements exploded on them at the moments of their most tender, broken, you know, confused place. And I love that you are helping us just really understand accurate, kind, gentle ways forward in these realms. I would love to hear you talk about specifically your understanding of hope and what hope looks like in this broken world, and the difference between hoping for something and hoping in something. I'd love for you to speak to that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think my understanding of hope goes back to that time when my mother-in-law was dying. And again, it was one of those stories where you think, this is not how this is supposed to go, right? Like, I don't want this person who I love. She was 55 and she was dying of liver cancer. And I learned at the time that the Hebrew word for hope, I may have said this to you all before, but the Hebrew word of hope for hope is similar to the word for spider's silk. And scholars do not agree that that's intentional, but I took it as an image. If a spider, a strand of silk, is not tethered to 2 points, then it dangles uselessly. But if it is tethered to 2 points, a spider silk, it's like really, really, really strong, even though it's also gentle. And so that image of hope as something that is both connected to the pain of the present moment and the future promise, that to me has been the way I've understood hope as a way for us to begin to acknowledge the pain and reality of our current situation, to look forward to the promise for what we've been given, but also to kind of pull that promise into the present situation. So there is a sense of, as we hope that over, I mean, going back to the Romans 15, 13, like there, that overflowing hope is something that means it's being poured out into the present moment. So my mother-in-law is dying and we are having hope, which means we're beginning to see glimpses of honestly what her life will be like after she dies. You know, she's talking about heaven. She's asking us questions about what it will be like to be with Jesus. We're seeing her forgive people, forgive herself, to really come alive in ways that she never had before, even, and probably wouldn't have if she had just kept on living without having this terminal diagnosis. And so that has continued to be the case for me. I think that for Penny, when she was born, what it meant to have hope for her, I had to be pretty careful because it's really easy to manufacture an ideal of what, for me to try to take control and think, oh, my hope for her is that she will, I never did actually hope this, but like go to Princeton one day, or, you know, that she will be quote unquote healed of her Down syndrome. It just can be easy to try to manufacture a future. And I think we can get this confused with hoping. I guess what I think is that we need, our hope needs to be kind of constrained or something, bounded by the word of God and by the image that Jesus gives us for like a full humanity and what it means to be fully human. Mm-hmm. So I would have wanted Penny early on in her life to be, for any effects of Down syndrome to be taken away. I didn't want that for her. And over time, I began to recognize that really what I wanted was for her to become like a superhuman, that the way in which I envisioned kind of a perfected humanity was like we would be superheroes who had no need for other people and could do everything for themselves. And it's like, well, that's actually not at all a God-given understanding of our humanity as like filled with vulnerability, as needing one another always, and more foundationally, relying completely upon the love of God to sustain us. So I remember early on in Penny's life talking to my friend Jess, who has cerebral palsy and walks with canes. And I asked her, you know, do you think you'll walk with canes when you get to heaven? And she said, I've never thought about that before. And I was so struck by her being like, huh, that's kind of an irrelevant question. I mean, that was kind of her attitude, was like, walk with canes, don't walk with canes, get to be with Jesus. Like, that's what it actually means for me to be in heaven, like is to be in the presence of God. So just my point is just that my hope shifted. And maybe that's the difference between hoping in and hoping for, your other question, that when I had when my hope was in a transformation for Penny, according to my understanding of what it meant to have a full, good human life, that's really different than my hope being in Jesus and in the love of God, which then could shape what I hope for. And I continue to hope for Penny to have a really rich, deep, full life. I hope for friendship. I hope for community. I hope for her to have a relationship that's really meaningful, when she'll have a job, you know, all these types of things. But if I put my hope in those things rather than in the love of God, it gets distorted.
I was just going to echo, Amy Julia, that I would say for in years now of being in this disability space, the number of parents whose concerns for their children with disabilities are always about community. They want them to have friends and people to walk through life with them. And it's chilling to watch. It's quite painful, honestly, to watch parents that are so concerned for their children. But it is really beautiful to see, specifically in your instance, children with disabilities, just like Penny, thriving, doing so amazing, and really, like, I mean, She's just so outstanding, Amy Julia. And things like the program you guys do to plan for her future, they just they keep me awake at night. It just lights me up. Will you tell us about that for a moment? It's just so interesting, and I want to go through it.
I think we all should go through it. I agree.
Right.
So the idea is, so for example, if Penny wants to live independently when she's in her 20s, what are some things as a 15-year-old she might be able to learn how to do? Well, laundry. Laundry is something she could learn how to do. And so, you know, we put that down as a team goal. And that was one that I was responsible for helping with. And it really what it meant was once a week, I'm going to be with Penny and take the time, I don't know, 15 minutes to make sure that she does the different steps to do a load of laundry for herself. And one of the first things we realized, she's very small, is that she couldn't reach the place on the washing machine where you put the soap in. So we had to get a step stool. And that's such a little thing, but it's also one of those things where you could imagine if she's never been equipped with the possibility of doing laundry, she could go through her entire life, not be able to do laundry and essentially have one thing harder to living on her own. So that on the one hand, when you're 15 and you're talking about 10 years from now living independently, I mean, that there's so many things that would have to happen. On the other hand, saying, but next year, could you learn how to do the laundry?
Right.
Well, yes, I could. And so it's really empowering to really look at small steps towards a big goal and to do that again in community with other family members, other friends, people at the school, people outside of the school. So it's been a wonderful process for us.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah. It's really. Yeah, I did a lot of OT after the stroke to relearn just how to live, how to be. They called them ADLs, activities of daily living, just how to be in the world when your body doesn't work or maybe you're neurodivergent. How do you do that? And that's really cool. That's just so incredible. Through your school, they're doing this program that, empowers kids. Wow, I love that so much.
Well, and you're absolutely right that it would be good for all of us. And we've thought about churches offering this just to any middle school or high school kid to say, can we as a community of adults who care about you come around you and say, what are your hopes and dreams? What are your strengths? What, you know, how can we help you and support you as you walk through these years ahead? And, you know, it's really been a gift to our whole family. And I think also, and I'm sure you all see this all the time, for people in the midst of suffering, that's often the case for people experiencing disability, chronic illness, all of those things. It can be really hard for a couple reasons, both practical and I think spiritual and emotional, to look towards a positive future. And yet, if you can do that, it also can be what really makes the difference in moving from a painful reality towards one that actually does involve, whether it's friendship or employment or some measures of, you know, independence or what did you call it? ADL, something daily living. And wanting something like the path is actually it's like a vehicle of hope because it gives you a way to move from what can often feel like a kind of stuck place slowly, like deliberately towards a different place.
I think finding those avenues to hope like that, even ones that feel out of the sort of spiritual box or the typical sort of set of tools we might think of the church using to illuminate hope in somebody's life. Just, it feels so helpful and just hopeful in that sense too, because I think so much of what we're having to do is redefine hope. Those of us who sort of understand a theology of hope. I don't know. I think about early on in our, after the stroke, we getting better and going back home was really what our hope was anchored in so many ways, because it had been such a reversal.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had such a deep community and a deep sense of wanting to return back to just our life as it used to be. And certainly then you return back after you've suffered and you realize you're different and there's no way to go back to what life used to be. And so that creates this real crisis of hope of like, well, what's the point of this? I can't even hang on to anything.
Yeah.
You know, if these sort of outcome-based hope is not really hope in its most transcendent form. And And yet I think finding those avenues to hope again, redefining hope, certainly reorienting hope back to this sort of future anchoring promise in a different reality, but in the reality that we have access to, and that, like you said, we get to kind of pull ourselves into and pull, the kingdom of God into this place that feels maybe anything but hopeful. But I love that that visual. Like, what are those avenues that are bringing us towards hope? And maybe they're really out of the, again, the typical sort of spiritualized box. But I think hope is embodied too. I mean, quite literally in an embodied Savior. And so, and yet we, through our own bodies and our own humanity, get to sort of work out work out hope together. And anyway, that's the wheels are turning as we think through, what are the avenues of hope that sort of we can kind of use almost as that lifeline, like you're pulling yourself out. What was that movie? Oh, Princess Bride. I don't know why that just came to mind, but classic.
Okay. Classic. Yeah.
You know, they're in the quicksand, and then they just kind of, it's pretty scary.
I remember
quicksand. I don't know if that's even real. I hope never to accidentally walk across it. But anyway, there's that big vine, and he dives in, and he's just like, there is this really sense like of just suffocation of the weightiness of life sometimes. A lack of clarity and a lack of understanding when we thought the hope that we had was going to be enough, and it's just not. And so how do we continue to like put each other on our backs and just sort of like claw our way out of this despair? And so anyway, this is just helpful, especially with something like disability that has so many facets, that has so much against sort of a life that has different abilities and opportunities in this world, not made for those disabilities. How do you envision creating a version of the world that is made for people with disabilities when so much of the world that we all inhabit is not made for those disabilities? What are you seeing that's like making you excited, making you hopeful? It's really about disability. And again, that's a signpost to so many other things in the world and what it means to be human. But I think as we become advocates, when we become just energized by how we can help create spaces, even what's sort of exciting to you that you're seeing in those realms?
I mean, I think I agree with everything you just said, Jay, and I actually love the Princess Bride image, especially because there is that sense of you're not alone in the pulling yourself out. You know, like there's a both mm-hmm. and going on in terms of, I think somebody dives in with the vine and pulls somebody else out, right? Like there's just that sense of we do this for and with each other, which does seem to go back, even Catherine, to you saying like friendship is one of the deepest needs for families. So I guess what gives me hope, I'm going to say two things. One that is a broader thing. There's a guy named Eric Carter who writes a lot about communities of belonging and has created something called, I think it's called the Wheel of Belonging, which is talking about how churches, but this is true of other institutional spaces, can be creating spaces of belonging, particularly for people with disabilities. And he says, look, sure, make sure that you have wheelchair access and do, the basic things you need to do in order to achieve accessibility of communication and physical access. But what people think is a barrier to belonging, they think it's like all sorts of rules and regulations that we don't have the time and money for. Really, the barriers have to do with the postures of heart and the quality of our relationships and our willingness to actually build friendships and relationships. So that it's mostly has to do with what does it mean to accept people? What does it mean to assume that they are meant to be here and have a purpose and begin relationships of giving and receiving? So I do think for all of us in our everyday lives, in our church communities, in our schools, in our neighborhoods, having a different posture of the heart towards all people, but especially those who might not have kind of social access or physical access, makes that gives me hope that there are actually pretty manageable ways for that to happen, that it does not mean we have to tear down all our churches and build new buildings, right? Like, actually, there are some pretty simple steps to creating spaces of belonging. That gives me hope. Mm. But the second thing is recognizing that while I look at, you know, the state of special education or healthcare in our country or in our world, and I can name so many injustices and things that are just hard, I also recognize that my little world is one where I have influence. That big world is, it's very minimal, the influence I have, but I can actually facilitate relationships for my daughter. And I say this gives me hope, not just for her, but for all the people that she is actually encountering. I can do that for some of her friends who actually don't have some of the position, you know, of influence within our community that I do. And I happen to get to know them because they're her friends. And so I can advocate for them in different ways, whether that's by, you know, helping with a prom dress, which I got to do last year, or by actually talking to a school administrator on someone's behalf. So I think remembering it can, the big wide world out there can be so overwhelming. And yet asking the question of like, what can I do within my sphere of influence, which is pretty small, but also that's a place where I can participate in God's good work and trust that God's continuing to do that in all sorts of other places all the time. And that's not my work to do.
That's really cool.
That's encouraging, because I think, you know, the reality when you look around at, just the story of disability, when you look at the story of suffering in the world, I mean, in a country like ours, where we have the ability and the actual resource to change how the world looks for the least and the marginalized, and we don't do that more often than not, you know, it just, it's pretty overwhelming. And it just, and even in the state of Georgia, where we're in now, learning some of the legislation and the advocacy and some of the obstacles to people just getting sort of their legal access to being able to live a dignified life.
Yeah.
It's like federal law, but the states often don't choose to subsidize that. And Georgia's like, I think 48th out of 50 in terms of least subsidies for adults with disabilities. And so, you know, this is starting to like sort of open our eyes of, oh my gosh, can, you know, is there something we could do here to be helpful? How do we connect those dots? And yet knowing there's such this, I don't know, just this morass kind of all these, this red tape and things you have no control over. And so then reorienting back to, as you said, like this life around the table is worth the effort to create this communion, because it is healing and it's helping heal a little part of our microcosmic world that in so doing, I believe, just has this ripple effect. And it's not just sort of lip service or like, oh yeah, you don't need to like worry about the big stuff, just kind of take care of your own. It's almost so big, the issues that overwhelm these communities, that it's easier almost to just be like, I mean, what's the point? Nothing's going to change. Like, it's too complicated or whatever. I think even for us, probably coming off of COVID too, where we were just so disconnected and disembodied, this act of returning around a table, which is from, you know, the dawn of time, just how we as humans have found each other and nourished each other in all the ways, continues to be, in my opinion, one of the most important and sacred things that we can do to create those environments that begin healing our own individual communities, and then like go out from there in ways that are huge.
Well, and that's, I do think, you know, the phrase hurt people. The opposite is also true. Like that idea that healing begets healing. And so I think we see that when Jesus comes as a healer, what happens is more and more tell other people about Jesus and bring them to him. Like, and they become participants in the healing, not only in terms of bringing people to Jesus, but actually in community with each other. It can become very kind of kumbaya to go that way, because healing certainly takes time. But there is a sense in which healing begets healing. And so I think about you all, you know, starting MEND in Atlanta, as on the one hand, we could say it's just a signpost, right? Like, there's so many people who will not be employed by this coffee shop, you know, who will need jobs. Or we can say it's a signpost. This is pointing towards the reality that all of us want to experience of welcome, of inclusion, of purpose, mm-hmm. of all of the things that Hope Heals stands for. Mm-hmm. And that's worth it. Like maybe, sure, maybe it'll spawn other stores and other people to do the same thing. Or maybe it'll simply point to the reality that mm-hmm. all of us long for, where we do come to table together.
Yeah.
And so things like that are also signs of hope for me. But the other emphasis that you all have had in establishing and creating the space is for people with disabilities to feel very welcomed and have access to space as patrons.
Yes.
And so this should be a gathering of people who are, have disabilities and who do not live with them currently. And that actually is really beautiful too, that this isn't just about employment, but about creating a space for the whole community.
Thank you for saying that. And yeah, I think we are all called to do the creative best we can with our lives. And creativity is underrated in our world if it's not seen as productive and effective and checks a lot of the boxes. But why do we have to think within the boxes? Why don't we create a space that maybe will foster an interability that this world is yet to see? Like, why can't we dream big? I love that truth of Galatians 6:5, that each of us must take responsibility for doing the creative best that we can with our own lives. And I think so many people don't want to take responsibility for their hard story, honestly, much less get creative in how to live it out really well. And I see you doing that, and it's astonishing. From my first introduction to you, which was not in the order you wrote your books, but I first read White Picket Fences, right, when it came out. And I can remember in reading your words, you really just providing a gentle and deep dive into a Southern upbringing and conversations of privilege, entering the disability conversation. And I was just floored by how you so just succinctly and clearly spoke to, I don't know, so many issues of our day. You truly are like a culture shifting machine. It's our joy. It's our honor and joy to have this moment with you. I have like 18 more questions, but I'll save those for another day, I suppose. And just simply say that your words, your heart, even from this time, talking about things like social access versus physical access, or what this is all really about is the posture of the heart in conversations of accessibility, are really moving to me as we go through this process with men. Mm-hmm. So I just thank you for how you are bringing all discussions of disability and accessibility into the cultural lexicon. It's beautiful to watch, and it's clearly, clearly profound kingdom work. So it's an honor to partner with you, and you too, J-Wolf.
Well, thanks, Amy, Julia.
The honor is all mine. Thank you, thank you. Great to be with you both.
Thank you for joining us on the Good Hard Story podcast. To learn more about what we are doing, follow us on Instagram at Hope Heals. Check out all things Hope Heals at hopeheals.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this wherever you get podcasts, and please feel free to share this episode with somebody who needs to hear it. Good Hard Story Podcast is a production of Good Hard Story, LLC. It is produced and edited by Leah Case and Mary Austin Hall. And I am your fearless and fabulous host, Catherine Wolf. Come back and join us every week, where we believe that the good story and the hard story can be the very same story. With you and for you, friends.